Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me again is Darren Moser from The Nerd Party.
Hey, I'm ready to watch a movie, and this time it is one I have not seen.
That's right, and both of us have not seen this one. We are going to be watching Willow, the Ron Howard fantasy film from 1988, and I'm so glad I looked up the director, because for the longest time, so here's the thing, there are three movies that were released in the mid 80s that were all low budget, but
Lord of the Rings, it's fantasy, but it's not high budget fantasy.
Exactly, but it's so funny. So these all came out right around the same time. There were about three or four of them. So 1985, you saw Legend, Ridley Scott's Tom Cruise. With Tom Cruise,
yeah,
correct?
Which, that's another one I haven't seen, so maybe one day
we'll touch that. That could be a future Missing Frames. And then Lady Hawk, directed by Richard Donner, was released that year, starring Matthew Broderick, and Rutger Hauer, ironically enough, decided, I guess, he'd rather be in Lady Hawk than work with Ridley Scott again for Legend, although I don't know if Rutger Hauer was up for a part in Legend. And then in 1987, you had The Princess Bride, which was easily the most successful of the four films in this collection. Willow. Willow was 1988, and I'm not joking. I swear Ridley Scott directed Willow. For the longest time, I was like, yeah, Ridley Scott, right? No, that's Legend. But all those movies, with the exception of Princess Bride, I feel like I mix them up so much. Is that
the only one I've seen of all four of those is The Princess Bride. So
yeah, and I think 99% of our audience would probably say the same.
You found the missing frame decade. You found the window that all movies are hiding.
But these are great directors who all went and made a random offshot fantasy film in a time where
and high magic and kingdoms and witches and wizards, and it's all practical. I mean, this is the late 80s, so everything's practical.
You're
so far away from CGI, that's not even going to happen for another decade.
Exactly. And it's so, what kicked this off, I wonder? Can you think of anything that might have triggered this run of movies? Like, these are all great directors, and Ridley Scott had just come off Blade Runner, so he was kind of, everyone was like, oh, Blade Runner, whatever, who cares? We hadn't gotten
maybe
to the point
that's
where we
it. Maybe they
that.
Wanted to do something that was easier, quote unquote, like high sci-fi. You know, you have to build the world, whereas this, it's like, oh, we'll rent some horses, we'll you know,
get some wagons, some
the cat. The castle's only a model; doesn't even matter.
The costumes are all smocks and like.
I'd be interesting to look. I bet you, if we looked deeply, though, we'd find the one that made a ton of money. Because that always happens, you know. It's like there's one, like a high sci-fi movie comes out that makes a ton of money. Like, I was thinking like Gravity. Like Gravity comes out, and then boom, you have like The Martian, and you know all these other like same kind of in the same vein come out over the next 5-6 years because you know studios react and they're like, oh, this is popular now, and so something, maybe it was Robin Hood. When was
maybe
Robin Hood the actor? Gosh, why am I blanking on his name?
Robin Hood with the actor. That narrows it down.
Kevin Costner.
That wasn't until the 90s, though. So I have no clue what it was that made this happen. But it happened with high-profile directors making these movies. None of them did great business. None of them were well-received. And it's just fascinating. But this is all to say that I keep mixing Lady Hawk, Legend, and Willow up, but this is one we haven't seen. Back when we did The Abyss in February, that's your favorite movie that I hadn't seen, which was really good. And that was a movie that I'm excited to watch again at some point. I'm sure there's a Blu-ray release out there or 4K release out there on the horizon.
Supposedly we're getting one, but yet to happen. Although we had the opposite problem with Willow. Yes. It's even harder to watch.
Because it's not available on anything, apparently.
No.
It was released on DVD and Blu-ray, but if you go to Amazon, they're not, like, it's like a $45 third party seller.
Yeah.
They're not streaming anywhere. It's not streaming.
Maybe we need for it, because you said, what year did you say it was? 88. Which, this would be an anniversary year. So you'd think they'd do an anniversary edition.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing happened with, like, Tron. Like, the original Tron DVD was real ludicrously expensive until they did a re-release once Legacy came out.
It's so interesting, though, that this is on Blu-ray and they have... Usually, once it hits the Blu-ray threshold, it's, like, mass-produced and everywhere. You can find it. This is a movie I swear I see in $5 movie bins.
Oh, yeah. So, but yeah, we need the 30th anniversary edition of Willow. I mean...
Yeah.
It's Warwick Davis. I mean, who doesn't love Warwick Davis?
Exactly. And what's funny, another thing, just to reveal how little I know about this movie. I know Willow exists. This is a movie that's always been in the back of my mind, not on the forefront of movies I was desperate to see, but always one I knew about and wanted to see, mainly because of Warwick Davis. But another thing I did not know, aside from the fact that this is directed by Ron Howard, not Ridley Scott, is that George Lucas was heavily involved in this, which I feel like I did hear, but just totally forgot about. And he developed the story, but he developed it specifically for Warwick Davis after they met on Return of the Jedi.
So I'm pretty sure, because I'm doing this all sans computer, but I'm pretty sure Warwick Davis was 11 in Return of the Jedi, which would have been, like, let's say shooting in 82. So if this is 89, you know, then that's, you know, he's 7 years older.
Apparently,
so he's like around, he's around like 18.
Yeah, from what I read, it says that he was 17 years old when they shot Willow.
That makes
sense. So it must have been 87 and they released it in 88. So I thought that was kind of cool because it's Warwick Davis played Wicket, the main Ewok in Return of the Jedi. And he, like you said, he was a kid. And it's kind of cool that Lucas sort of took him under his wing and was like, let me make a movie for you to star in, because
Wicket, you know, like the fact that he carried that performance, because Wicket, like, you're under a complete suit, you can't, like, your face is, you know, animatronic, like, so there's 0% of your body that's being shown, you can't see your eyes, and you still have to emote out a character, and you're 11 years old, and he did it. So,
I'd
make a movie for him after doing that.
And I don't know. Warwick Davis, I've seen him in other stuff. I know he's great. So it'll be fun to watch him in this, because this is kind of his first, like, lead actor performance. And George Lucas, for some reason, was obsessed. I remember back when he was, I guess this is an idea or like a holdover from Lord of the Rings that he was inspired by. But he wanted, originally, like, Luke Skywalker was supposed to be a midget. And I guess he decided to just have that be Willow. Like, you know, eventually he was like,
that
okay, component I'm that
he
idea.
Tucked away.
Yeah,
it
but it
Willow.
Seems like he really latched on to the idea of, like, hobbits, or like a very small, unsuspecting individual ending up being the big hero of a story. So that finally got to pay off with this movie. And I think really Warwick Davis is what I'm most excited to see. There's a little part of me that's excited to watch Val Kilmer as well, because this is right at the point where I think he was just starting to become nuts.
I don't think he was a big thing yet, but it was just happening.
But he was still legendary for being just a total jerk. So I'm excited. Apparently he was super nice to Warwick Davis. I can't remember the exact story, but when they met on the airplane, apparently he was very nice to him.
Well, that's good.
There's some story with sunglasses. I feel like I should look that up, but I am.
Well,
we've seen Warwick in
a lot of Star Wars, because, like you said, Return of the Jedi, he was in Episode 1 as a fan in the crowd watching the pod race. And then that same character shows up in Solo. They've said it's the exact same character that he plays is now a part of Enfys Nest's gang in Solo. So we see him all over the place And he's in Harry Potter too, isn't he?
He plays Flitwick. Professor Flitwick.
Did he also play the other one in the later films, like Grimhook or something like that? Did he double dip and do a goblin as well?
Grimhook, yeah, you're right. He was in the very last movie. He was the goblin that takes Harry to the vault that they have from Bellatrix Lestrange. But okay, I found the sunglasses story. So like we were saying, Val Kilmer was apparently just a huge dick. And at this point, he was starting to get to that point in his career where he was just kind of a jerk. But Warwick Davis met him. Apparently, they met at the airport, and Warwick Davis had a pair of fake Ray-Ban glasses on. Val boarded the plane. He snatched the sunglasses off Warwick Davis's face and snapped them in two. And Warwick Davis was like, "Oh, okay." And then Val Kilmer produced actual Ray-Bans and said, "These are way cooler," and gave them to him, which is super nice. And he said he was very nice on set.
So you start off
very funny
as a jerk in your story, but then you turn it. I mean, even in that story, and it's cute, but the way he goes about it is like if there was no punchline, no second part of that joke, like. Then he is a big jerk.
Right. But the great thing is, apparently he ad-libbed almost all his dialogue in this film.
Warwick or
Val Kilmer.
So you didn't want to learn his lines, and he just ad-libbed everything.
This is after Top Gun, isn't it? So he is a little famous at this point.
That's true.
Very famous at this point after Top Gun, because that was such a huge hit. That's I'm looking forward to. And it'll be interesting. You know, Ron Howard's a director I really like a lot. And there are movies of his I love. I think he's done some really great stuff. But I saw the movie Cocoon a few years ago, which I think was his feature debut, and I did not like it. So I'm interested to see whether this falls into Cocoon.
Cocoon can grow on you. It's not it's like that's that other decade where you had like Batteries Not Included and Cocoon and
Mac and Me,
Explorers and Flight of the Navigator, where it was just like throw it at the wall sci-fi. Like, will it stick? Okay. Like, no one was caring about
you can trace that back to like E.T. and Star Wars had already kind of pioneered.
And Cocoon
like,
got
effects
a sequel
heavy.
Too. I mean, I don't right. even yeah, but
yeah, so it's it's all very interesting. I've wanted to see this movie. I have been interested in seeing it, but it has kind of a reputation, right? Like people do like this movie a lot, don't they?
I don't hear anyone say they hate Willow. It's just one of those things like they either enjoy it or it's not their like favorite. Like they're obviously apparently DVD sales aren't going through the roof, but and I don't know a ton about it. I know there's Willow, he's the the little person, and he's on an adventure, like you said, kind of very Hobbit-esque. Val Kilmer plays the sword wielding sidekick hero, maybe he's also a hero, and right. I have no idea who the villain is. I don't know if it's a monster or a person. Maybe there's a baby involved. I think I remember like a baby in a basket. So I'm assuming it's probably one of those like heir to the throne, we got to protect the baby, the court gesture kind of plan.
Right. And Will is Willow Warwick's character. That's the name of his character.
Yeah. His little name. Yeah. His name is Will, as far as I know. So, and I think he's just like a farmer or like some
and he gets
peasantry.
Involved.
Yeah.
It's always a farmer. Always a farmer with George Lucas, just hanging out, minding their own business.
So
well, that'll be
so Ron Howard directed. So did George produce this?
I'm sure he did. This is Lucasfilm. So he developed the story. So it must have been something he developed for Lucasfilm. But it didn't do great at the box office. It did decent, but not like anything substantial. And
A budget of $35 million, gross $57 million. So that's double, almost double. So that's not.
Yeah, it's not terrible.
That's what it was like in the 80s,
Yeah, it wasn't enough. Apparently they wanted to do sequels and stuff, and then they just kind of decided to do books and things like that. But it has like a 50-something% on Rotten Tomatoes. So the reception was lukewarm. It looks like it hasn't, it's not one of those movies that people have since embraced as like, oh, we didn't know what we were talking about. That still seems to be the consensus, is that the movie is kind of like, oh, it's okay. It seems very much, what's interesting about it is Willow is, if we're talking in the timeline of Star Wars and Lucasfilm, it's right after Return of the Jedi finished. Temple of Doom had just come out, and while it was a success, people were kind of tore into it a little bit for being darker and more obnoxious and kind of annoying. So Willow is kind of the, is their life in terms of fantasy and space and sci-fi outside of Star Wars. As a time capsule, that's going to be interesting to see, like, what its style is, like, what direction they were going in with it creatively. And mostly I'm really excited because I think Warwick Davis is wonderful. Did you ever see the show, is it Life's Too Short? Is that the name of the show he did with Ricky Gervais?
Oh, I've seen like clips of it where they're like in business suits and they're having a chat or something like that.
It's like a mockumentary style, very similar to The Office. It's absolutely hysterical, and it's very improv heavy, and man, it is so good. And there's a great clip where Warwick Davis has Val Kilmer on the show, and Val Kilmer keeps walking into the room. He's like, wait, hold on, I've got this great bit I do. And he puts on a Batman mask, and it's absolutely amazing. But so I'm excited to see him in this.
I was looking at Ron Howard, and this, I don't think this actually was his directing debut. I think
Cocoon was.
And Splash. He did Splash.
That's right.
So 80s. So you have Splash, Cocoon, Gung Ho, which I enjoyed. Have you ever seen Gung Ho?
No, I haven't.
It's how to describe Gung Ho. It's a Japanese car company buys an American car company, and the lead is Michael Keaton, and he goes over to Japan, and he's basically trying to keep him from shutting down the plant. And it's very blue collar, white collar, culture clash, East meets West, and so he makes a deal where they're like, okay, well, we're gonna produce this many cars in the summer, or they'll shut us down. And so the Americans are having to learn how to like actually, you know, like mass produce and do it with quality, whereas they're normally like, oh, like, hey, we got our jobs, we got our pensions, you know, whatever, we're fine. Right. But so I enjoyed it.
My
pleasures.
So Ron Howard has worked with Michael Keaton and Val Kilmer.
Yep.
So he's worked with two Batmans. Now all he needs is to work with, he sadly can't work with Adam West, but if he works with Kevin Conroy, Christian Bale, and George Clooney, and then Ben Affleck. Has he worked with Ben Affleck? I don't know. There's some Batmans out there Ron Howard hasn't worked with.
He's worked with a lot. So you have Splash, Cocoon, Gung Ho, and then Willow, and it's just like boom, 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 boom. But definitely early in his
trajectory.
Career.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So it'll be interesting to see. My anticipation levels for this are relatively lukewarm. I'm not expecting to like it. I'm hoping to at least kind of find it to be sweet or a nice way to spend some time, because it's a long ass movie. It is 2 hours long, so I hope I get something out of it. But I'm glad I can check this off my missing frames list, because I've been meaning to watch it for a while.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I'm expecting at least to like Willow the character. I think, you know, from what I've heard, he definitely does a good job, and if the other parts don't hold up, or the story, or Val Kilmer's character, you know, then that's okay. I'm fine with that, as long as Willow is the heart and soul of the movie, which I can't imagine him not being, then I think we'll be fine. But
okay, great. So you'd say you're on, in terms of, are you expecting to enjoy it? Are you hopeful?
I'm not expecting it to be like Princess Bride levels of like I don't hear anyone quoting Willow, like, ever.
Right.
But I've never heard someone say they watched Willow and hated it either. So I'm expecting, you know, like Kroll. Like, this is kind of that Kroll era where it's like, okay, that was a cool movie. Like, you know, it's like taking fantasy and throwing it at the wall. Like I said, it's like, okay, here's a story about this. It's fantasy. It's definitely, you know, you got magic and horses and dwarves and all that. But no, I'm expecting to enjoy it. But At $41 a pop, I'm not sure if I will buy the DVD.
Fair enough. Well, let's get to it and find out if you're wrong.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Darren, I'm going to let you take the lead on this. How do you feel about Willow?
It was a wonderful adventure. It's everything I expected it to be and more.
Which, is that a good thing or a bad
thing?
No,
it's a good thing. I mean, like we said before, you know, this movie was always kind of in the background, like, oh, it's Ron Howard, I know Ron Howard. Oh, it's Warwick Davis, I know Warwick Davis. And it's like, this is exactly the kind of goofiness you get from like an 80s high fantasy, like, you know, Lord of the Rings is a distant future, you know, where we're gonna take everything super seriously and it's gonna make, it's like, no, we're just gonna and they're all gonna be little people and it's just gonna be great.
Right, this is back before fantasy was the thing that was a force to be reckoned with. It was literally just like a laughingstock. I have such conflicted feelings about this movie, Darren. I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it. This is
now.
The
remind
strangest...
me. Did you see it in the '80s, or this is much more recent that you saw it for the first time?
This is it. This is the only time I've seen it. I did not go back in time.
You did not go back in
show
time
it to myself.
So
in the '80s.
I mean, it's probably one of those films where, without that super nostalgia hook, I mean, there's a lot of movies like that, like Goonies. Like, Goonies is good, but like, I know people who love Goonies because they watched it, you know, when they were little.
When they're kids, yeah.
Yeah, and like, neither of us watched Willow when we were little. Or, sorry, is it the acronym WILLOW? Because like, the posters got dots, so maybe it's a secret acronym.
Yeah,
what does it stand for?
Maybe that's what it is. It's the mystery of what Willow actually means, the acronym, and not the movie itself. Darren, I didn't not like this movie.
Right.
But I didn't like it. It was the weirdest. There were things about it that I was like, I really enjoy this. And then there were things about it that I really didn't enjoy. And I felt about as indifferent to the final product as I think I expected to feel. but not slanting negative. There's a way where there are certain movies where you watch them and you sit there and you're like, I don't care about this and I'm miserable. This is a movie where I was like, I don't really care about this, but there's like a sweetness to it.
Yeah. There's an innocence to the whole movie.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
It's very hard to just outright dislike, even though I wouldn't say I liked it.
Well, and also, this is, you know, you're just starting to get into the amazing age of visual effects. Like, visual effects are still, I mean, yeah, we've had Star Wars and a lot, all of that's come out before this, but on a budget, on a much smaller budget, I mean, this was only $35 million in 1988. And so, but you had because we're still firmly rooted in the age of practical effects, it looked really good. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it didn't look too bad. There was some stuff like, a couple of the monsters and some of the effects were goofy, but for the most part,
right.
I think a lot of it was just there's something about fantasy movies pre Lord of the Rings where they just look bad in general.
Right.
It's the makeup, it's the hair, it's the costumes. It screams not like this is a world I believe in and can totally buy exists somewhere. It just screams like this is a movie. These are sets. These are people wearing costumes. I can't believe it. And I can't buy into it. And that creates this disconnect that makes it feel very silly to me. And I think that's what a lot of people felt about the fantasy genre before Lord of the Rings, is that was really kind of pushed it into the realm of this is a world that could have existed and you can totally
right.
buy
it's
into
it. It's a fairy tale.
Exactly. And it's a fairy tale world, but it feels cheap to me. But the effects, like you said, they have that kind of 80s old school charm. I know there were some stuff like ILM did
the morphing technique yeah.
for the first time,
which was pretty amazing, especially for 88. Like, it looked, you know, the changing between animals and then, I mean, you have the practical effects, like the whatever exactly they were called, the devil dogs, you know, those are obviously dogs in costumes.
In masks. How do you get that to work? I never understand when they're like, let's get real dogs and just put masks on them.
Well, they did that in Solo as well.
Right.
So,
I'm amazed when that works because I feel like these poor dogs, I can't even put a Halloween costume on my dog without her, like, you know, acting.
It's
like
a
I'm
Ron Howard
her.
Staple now. You have to have the dogs in the costumes if it's a Ron Howard movie.
I know. We've got to go back to A Beautiful Mind and create a special edition where we just put in images of dogs with masks on and make that one of his hallucinations. But yeah, you know, it's a tough movie. Like I was saying, the charm to it is there. You can sense it. It's not just
Warwick,
you know,
Davis
really,
is charming, no matter what.
It's effective enough in that way that I can watch this and say, yeah, I can see how someone who maybe saw this when they were 5 years old, who maybe hadn't ever seen Star Wars or another movie, could really latch onto this as their like fantasy adventure movie. I mean, do you know many people? We talked about it a little bit, but do you know specifically people who like rave about this movie? And
not a one. No, it's. I mean, right. it's one of those movies that I've never heard anyone talk down about it.
Yeah,
but I've never heard anyone like, you know, boy, I really need to get my Willow fanfic going because I just want to live in this world. Nope, it's like this is the story. It's done. You know, and
it must be in my imagination because we both wanted to watch this movie and it was a great suggestion from you. And Willow, to me, in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a like a beloved like family film. But you look at it like, you know, we talked a bit about it, but the reviews are not great. It did not get a great reception. People don't necessarily talk about this movie a lot. It's not like a big fan favorite, like Labyrinth.
It's not a huge. It's not a huge feather in Lucasfilm and like in their cap. It's like, I mean, it's like we did this. I'm sure it pushed technology forward and it was a fun story. Like it's just a movie.
Well, what do you think that, so, you know, with a movie like Labyrinth, which we did that for Missing Frames. I did it with Lindsay Kendrick. It's one of her favorite movies.
That's right. I remember listening to that one.
Yeah. That's a movie that I didn't really like that much, and I guess I saw the appeal of it, but to me, the appeal of Willow is there's more charm to Willow. So why is it that a movie like Labyrinth gets all the credibility, whereas a movie like Willow kind of, there's some, but it doesn't feel as enthusiastic as Labyrinth? And part of me just wonders if it's just cooler to like Labyrinth because David Bowie's in it.
Yeah. I mean, imagine Labyrinth without David Bowie, and it's like, I can't. But yeah, I think it's also, I think, because your protagonist is not, I was going to say human, but that's not what I mean, because he is human. But he's, you know, okay.
In the movie, he's not human. He's like another species.
He's a other spelling for dwarf or something like
that. He's a not hobbit.
Yeah, a not hobbit. But I guess I'm seeing, okay, well, who is your audience trying to connect to? Are they connecting to the baby child that has no control over everything? Are they connecting to Willow? Or are they connecting to Val Kilmer's character? That's pretty much it. Maybe the princess, you know, the evil princess.
That was Very early on, you get the sense that who am I supposed to be? Not who you're supposed to be rooting for, because you immediately are like, oh, I like Willow. He's charming. Right. And Warwick Davis is wonderful. Like, immediately I was like, oh, he's a natural. It's nice because I like him a lot. I think the show Life's Too Short is just fantastic, and I think he's a great actor wherever he appears. And it's nice to see him, like, you don't see him a lot just like as himself. I mean, there's some makeup in this, but he, you know, he's wearing a wig and I think maybe he has pointy ears. So it's really him. And that so young, he had that charisma and he's gives such an endearing performance. That was an immediate thing where I was like, okay, I think I can bear this movie. I think a lot of it has to do with Warwick Davis.
Oh yeah.
But
he's the David Bowie of Willow. Basically.
Yeah, he really is. Well, in some ways, that argument could be made for Val Kilmer, but we'll get to that. But but you're right.
That's true.
There's not really, Willow doesn't really drive the story in the same way that if you look at like Star
it's
Wars,
it's happening
as the heroes
to him.
Yeah, a lot of it is happening to him. Which you could make the argument that Luke, a lot of it is happening to him, but he does. there's a little bit more of the sense of stakes and sacrifice with Luke. Like, Luke's family is killed.
Yeah.
He has nothing. His father.
Are you literally comparing Willa to Star Wars now? Like, that's right, a hard, well, that's a hard comparison.
I mean, let's just do it. But let's, because it's really, I mean, you have Star Wars, which is really, aside from us being huge nerds and loving Star Wars, as just from a cinematic storytelling experience, it's about as perfect as movies get.
Right.
And as
it's the hero's journey personified.
Exactly. It's about as perfect as storytelling gets. And it's, you compare the two. So you take Star Wars as an ideal example and Luke as an ideal protagonist and compare it to Willow, which is a not so ideal example. And Willow's a not so ideal protagonist, though not without his charms. But you look at Luke, who's lost everything, who comes from a tough background, who longs for something greater and gets the chance to do something greater and to really make a difference. And you know what the Empire is. You know what the stakes are. But with Willow, he's a guy who kind of just doesn't want to do anything. It's very similar to Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit. Like, oh, I just want to stay at home and do my thing. But it's like he already has a family. He has a really good life.
Yeah.
And there's
he's
no sense
really
that they're
not off-putting, but the fact that from the gate he kind of doesn't want to do it, I think that lingers throughout the whole rest of the film.
Yeah, and it's, I don't, it may have been okay if there was a sense of like, oh, there's danger, or he feels a need to protect his family, but he doesn't, he's not really driven by anything. He's just like, oh, I just want to help this kid. And it, but it's not a strong motivation. It
right.
feels very like, I think it's a combination of the fact that he's kind of like an unwilling protagonist in a way that isn't exciting or engaging. But also, you don't really get a sense of the stakes. Like, you don't know what
you're
he doesn't
told
have anything
the
to
stakes
fight.
A lot, but you're not shown the stakes a lot.
Yeah, he doesn't really have anything to fight for. He's not trying to save his family. He's not trying to save his village. They get attacked, but there's no sense of like, oh, we've got. It's like we take the child away and everything's fine. And it's like, well, that's not really a problem. So the villain is like set up to
proximity.
Be, oh, right. The villain is kind of like, oh, they're evil. But I think that's one of the biggest things about Lord of the Rings and Star Wars that really make it effective is right from the get go. You get the sense of like, here's what's at stake. And also, here are the bad guys. They
right.
are terrifying. They're strong. They have the upper hand. Yeah, what are you going to do? And with Willow, there's none of that. So you're kind of on this sort of meandering journey.
Well, and speaking of the bad guys, I mean, we have kind of the main three. We have the evil queen, we have the princess, and we have the general.
Right.
And, I mean, the evil queen's pretty, I could see that being some nightmare fuel, you know, for some little kids. Like, she's pretty intense. And also the fact that she's in many scenes with the child, you know, putting, you know, like, I know a lot of people who don't like movies where babies are put in harm's way, like
right.
that just really rubs them the wrong way, and that's how they can't make that disconnect, you know, that it's a film. And I mean, we could all see the love subplot a mile away, like it was really really obvious,
very
but,
pronounced
but and then you had the general, and you know, you had a lot of like,
speaking of the general, I just realized this. I literally realized this, and I confirmed it while you were talking, just looking. Not that I wasn't listening to you.
No.
I was listening to you,
General
Keel. But I had to look this up. But I want the audience to know I thought of it before I looked it up, and I looked it up to confirm it, and this is how much of a Superman nerd I am. I realized that the guy who played the general, I was like, who is he? He's not – he looks like Walter Peck from
Ghostbusters.
He looks like the principal from Ferris Bueller. I was like, but he's not either of those guys. He is Brad, the bully from Smallville in Superman 3. He is that jerk. I can't believe I was like, what was it? Oh, it was Superman 3, and I just looked it up, and that's him. But sorry,
no. It's well,
I need the world to know
connections.
I need the world
yeah.
to know that I know my Superman 3.
Well, so we had that. I mean, and then you have like the high fantasy elements, like the brownies, which was pretty good compositing, you know, for what it was, with the little tiny, you know, pygmy people, or I guess Lilliputian more is the more accurate term. But and you, I guess I feel like this is a movie of a cross between a low budget, the Fellowship of the Ring mixed with the Court Jester. because the court jester has not so much for the comedy, but more so for the there's a child and there's a prophecy and we have to keep it away from the king, and like that element is very similar,
right?
But and you just, you know, you have the reluctant knight. I mean, it's original, but it's original composition of many very formulaic pieces.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the twist of Star Wars had the effects. Like Star Wars took us to literally a galaxy we'd never seen before, whereas Willow doesn't have the benefit of that. This is a story we've heard before, we've heard different iterations of it, and we're hearing it here in a way that we've heard already and we've seen already, and it doesn't have really anything new to add to the table, which really works against it.
You know, I was just thinking, it'd be interesting if we were introduced to Willow as he has just been chosen to be the new apprentice sorcerer, and he's still learning, and this is his first big test. So he has some confidence in his abilities, but the problem is he's it's hard to be behind a character that doesn't really want to go on the adventure and doesn't really have confidence in his own abilities. Like, how am I supposed to root for you when you don't root for yourself?
Yeah, and there was something about, like, this is going to, I don't know how to say this without it sounding really terrible, but something about him, like, being a dad and having a wife, I guess it was supposed to, like, oh, he wants to get back home to his family, but there was something about that that made him feel so, like, settled. Like, he didn't need, with Luke and with Frodo, they need something. Like, they needed something. You know, Bilbo, you can make the argument, he doesn't really, he finds out later on that he did need to go on the journey. But with Willow, there's never a need. And even at the end, it's not like, oh, I'm glad I went on the journey. It's like, oh, I'm glad I'm back home. With Bilbo, he's grown as a character. Willow doesn't really grow as a character. He just learns magic. So it's like all these characters have something that they need. So the fact that he already had everything he needed, and it wasn't really so much about him finding himself as it literally was just, it's a surface level journey of him delivering this child. There was kind of a little bit of like, oh, he's not a great magician. I don't know. I don't know what his journey was supposed to be.
Well, and I guess maybe impartially, we don't know the context of sorcerers. Is it easy? Can anyone be it? Do you just have to know the words? Do you have to just believe it enough? Like, none of that is established. So we don't know him versus anybody else. But I feel like him being a parent was put in there to make him connect with the fate of a babe. So that's why at the end, because the sorcerer says, like, what is this child to you? Like, if you want to, Willow, you can just walk away. And he's like, no, like, I'm a dad, I make a connection.
But here's the thing, he has kids, so it's not that much of a stretch to think, like, oh, he like a baby. I know at first he immediately,
that's what I'm saying,
like,
why they made him not a single or not like a...
Well,
non-father.
It almost would have benefited, I feel like, if they had, because then you have this guy who doesn't have a family and feels a connection to this kid. Maybe he's like, you could kind of give him a backstory of maybe he's avoided like having a family or allowing himself to live that life. And then this baby can kind of come, and it's almost more effective that way. So the family element was, to me, it was like a superfluous addition to give him some manner of like, oh, sympathy. There's something he's trying to get back home to. But to me, it's like it wasn't effective in that way, because Willow doesn't really have anything he's striving for. All he wants to do is get back home eventually, and he's not really, I don't know. It didn't feel like he was fighting for anything. But then on top of that, the villains are so goofy and stupid. It's so hard to do villains in like a fantasy movie, and especially in this case where they're literally just like, find that child!
Right, over and over and over.
Exactly. There's no nuance. There's not even really a moment where I think they establish how much of a threat they are. They just, like, they have their evil hounds, and then she turns everyone into pigs at the end, which is a really fun effect with Val Kilmer's makeup. But other than that, like, it's, do they ever really establish that, like, oh, this woman's terrifying and she, like, does something
again, that's where
crazy?
It feels like the court jester, where it's just, like, we're told that and we see that happening, but we don't get a sense of the larger kingdom. I mean, the fact that they camp out right outside the castle and they're like, hey, we're here, like, protesting. And I honestly, one of the most interesting characters was, I can pronounce his name, Burglecut, the village leader who is kind of sassing Willow in the very beginning and wants his land. Like, just overall, he was actually fairly interesting. Like, you could tell he had some motivation. Like, he, you know, he didn't really want to go, you know, but he was forced into it and he wants Willow's land. Like, I know he's not the antagonist, but we actually almost know more about what's driving him from the beginning than we do about many other characters.
No, you're right. But I think one of my, I was kind of like, I don't know how I feel about this movie, but then Val Kilmer shows up, and that to me kind of injected it with new life. And I think part of it is because Val Kilmer was just completely bonkers in all of the place.
Oh, he was nuts. Yeah.
And he apparently improvised all his lines, but that, it makes it so much more charming. And I really, Val Kilmer, what's the character's name? Is it, it's Mad Mardigan. I really liked him, but again, it's another character where you're told a lot of like, oh, this guy is a knight. He is disgraced. He does this, but we don't know a lot about him. We don't learn a lot about him. It's like very like nobody is really motivated by anything. They're just kind of all caught up in the riot. And, with him, it's very clearly a Han Solo type character where it's like, oh, you know, he's a bad guy. But really, he's got a heart of gold and he's going to come back and help Willow and he's going to save the day. But there's not a whole lot of that. He just kind of is there from the point they meet.
And I mean, he's there, and then they leave with the child, and you're like, I don't trust this guy worth anything. Like, what are you doing? And then he comes back.
I didn't understand that at all. Again, in terms of Willow's character, why he thought that was a good, it doesn't make sense.
Well, I guess maybe if they had done a little more Lord of the Ring-ish, and it's like his, because in the beginning, his only goal is to take him to the crossroads and get rid of him. Which is not really the best goal, but maybe if they had started with that and then Willow realizes, I can't just leave this child here. I need to be the one who takes it to X. Well, I mean, that does happen, but because of the sequence after he's already given it away, like, it
right. The difference is,
it's a little
again,
disjointed.
With Frodo, Frodo makes the choice, which makes him, you know, at first this is thrust
Willow's
upon
kind
him.
Of forced into it because
exactly.
of circumstances.
Willow's kind of forced into it, and he's just kind of like, well, I guess I'll do it. He never really has that moment, that defining moment where it's like, ah, yes, he's a hero. With Frodo, you have the moment at the Council of Elrond where he says, I'm going to take the ring even though it's not my responsibility. I'll do it. And that makes you love him even more. But with Willow, it's just like, oh, this kid. They almost had that moment early on when he brings the kid over. He's like, we're not going to fall in love with this baby. And then he immediately falls in love with the baby. It's like they kind of show their hand a little too early as far as the story and kind of structuring it effectively.
You know, I know his kids were really little, but if his kids had been a little older, this would have made a really great like father-son adventure movie.
Yeah, you could have had that element in there. That was tough because I think they should have just gotten rid of the family altogether, not murdered them. But like
okay, we
there.
See how it's going.
Also, those poor little kids, they were so cute, but like I you couldn't understand them, and I could just see Ron Howard on set just being like, all right, we'll just ADR it later, but I guess he forgot.
We'll fix it in post. We'll fix
He's
it
like,
in post.
He's like, they're so adorable, no one's going to care what they say. They
and
don't
I mean,
be understood.
Again, like, it's fantasy, so it kind of takes a, what's the word? Takes the ability of we could just do kind of whatever, and that's kind of the known status of low fantasy, I'd say. And so all I'm saying is, like, you know, you have the love potion or love dust that makes, you know, Mad Morgan fall in love with the warrior daughter, and it's funny. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just it feels like there's these little sequences we're being strung along, and then he gets the wand in this magical forest scene, and then he tries to change the high wizard back into a woman, and it's like there's all these little beats, but they don't flow together as well as it probably could have.
None of them are really set up. Like, we don't feel the impact of, like, I mean, I guess there is the moment where the angel or the witch, whatever it is, that tells Willow, like, you must be the one to save the child. And he's like, I can't do it. I'm nothing. And I guess that's supposed to be his Frodo moment. But it doesn't feel earned. It doesn't feel like anything is set up in a way to really make you feel those moments.
Like, again, not that any of the hobbits wanted to go on an adventure, but once they did, they fully embraced it.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, it would have been really interesting if Willow had been an apprentice mage and really wants to get out of the, you know, Hobbiton, a.k.a. whatever the place was called. But he really wants to go and get out. And he's like, the master's like, no, like, you're not ready yet. And then this adventure comes along, and the master's like, I'm hecka old. I can't do it. You need to do it. And he, you know, pull the right finger, and he goes off on his adventure. Like, if that's how we had started, even if he had had a family, just like that, that accepting the call to adventure, I think would have toned the movie in a much better way from the get-go.
Yeah. Need that, and you need the establishment of what's at stake. Because it feels like the world feels very...
It felt very small.
It felt very not... It felt like there were three locations.
Yeah.
Maybe three sets shot on the same locations, but it felt very small and...
Well, it is small because we keep running into Mad Mardigan. He's obviously right around
also,
the corner.
It's like, you know, there's never a point where you feel like the villains are a threat to the things that these people hold dear. They're like willingly throwing themselves into the path of danger, which is fine, but it doesn't feel like it matters much.
Well, and I mean, I am impressed how well they transport the child. I mean, that's relatively a very difficult task, but they had the little, you know, backpack and it all. I'm like, okay, I could actually buy how they moved it along. Like, that made sense. But
you know what's funny? Roger Ebert's review of this movie, he brings up all the, like, pandering cutaway shots of the baby.
Right.
And because I read that, I glanced at that before I watched the movie. Every time they cut to the baby, it just became really obnoxious to me. But it's true. I mean, they cut
to
the kid.
Guess what?
This
is totally a real kid. See? Right. See? Okay, well, now we go back to the action.
But it's also like the goofy, like, make a cute face to emphasize
the good take where it's the freaking happiest baby I've ever seen. I mean, this baby almost never cries.
No, but it was pretty excited to be caught up in a horrible predicament.
Well, and I mean, maybe that's what we're overshadowing, like, the very beginning where, you know, the baby's born and, like, the media, they're like, oh, we're gonna go get the queen to kill your child. It's like, oh man, this is kind of intense. But you know, and then we Moses him out into the river and
the boat, the little basket that was perfectly made. Just waiting for them.
I felt that would have been interesting if the baby was maybe a tiny bit older, because I got the impression that a bit of time had passed that the nursemaid had been fleeing. Like, they kind of, you know, they showed her.
Oh yeah, that was very weird. There are moments where this movie structurally it really doesn't hold together, but that opening where it's just like kind of like a time lapse of
I'd expected almost a year to have passed, and maybe it's like this little 1 year old, but it's like maybe a week or a month. I don't know. Yeah, I can't tell.
You don't get a good sense of that, and the movie kind of does that throughout. Like we were saying, it has all these moments that feel very rushed through, that don't feel earned, and it's hard to connect with anything because you're not quite sure what's happening, where are they, what's going on. I don't know. I but at the end of the day, it's not a movie I am like upset.
I'm okay not owning this movie.
Yeah,
like, I'm fine
glad
with
we
that.
Didn't spend
I've seen it. I can check it off the list. I can do my missing frames episode, and then I'm good.
Exactly. This movie at the very least gave us this episode. But I'm glad we didn't spend $100 on the Blu-ray on Amazon.
Speaking
of which, did you see the video I sent you of Val Kilmer and Warwick Davis?
I have not. I didn't get a chance to watch it
yet.
We've got to
find a way
to
share that with our beautiful community because it's so funny. But
Val Kilmer was good though. Let's talk some positives.
I really like Val Kilmer in this movie. We've harshed a little bit
on the film, but
Val Kilmer and Warwick Davis were easily the highlights for me. Well, that's true. We have been beating up on this. So what were the things you liked about Willow?
So I think Val Kilmer, I mean, it took me a little bit to get to warm up to his character because he's really kind of a jerk in the very beginning.
And he's almost in an entirely different movie in some ways. He's kind of doing his own thing.
Yeah. Like as Willow and his compatriots are sizing him up, I'm trying to size him up. Like, what is this guy all about? And then it's like, are you nuts? Are you... you know, he's the kind of guy that, like, I'm nuts because everyone says I'm nuts. And, like, but are you?
Yeah,
like, I don't know.
Really, yeah.
And, you know, he was a fun character. And, like, I like the subplot with the princess is kind of funny. And I like the subplot with his friend who's, like, the Legionnaire. And, you know, that, you know, one more brother at arms thing. Like,
right.
You know, and it's just, I think it's more funny the fact that he's not always with Willow. Like, they part ways a couple of times, and then it's like, oh, next town over, here you are again. Like,
yeah,
that's,
I
again,
know.
It makes it feel super small.
Exactly.
But no, overall, I liked Val Kilmer with Mad Mardigan. It's one of those names where it's like they say it a million times. Like,
and you'll,
you know,
never remember it.
Well, but I mean, like, you know, you just hear it a lot in the movie. It's like a verb. And
yeah.
And it's like almost like he's talking in the third person, like, oh, I'm Mad Mardigan, we'll do such thing. And
right.
I like the little keep, you know, that they defend with the, where he gets it all set up and he gets the armor. I don't know where this place came from. It's like super stocked. But and then you had, I'd seen that monster, that two-headed snake beast. I'd seen video clips of that because it's, you know, ILM, but I never knew what it was from. And then you had the, and then very labyrinth feeling were those trolls that crawled along the walls that were just all black and furry, and they looked pretty creepy. That's
that was definitely
creepy.
You know, why is it that, like, sword battles in the, it, like, there's a charm to, like, movies from the 30s through
right.
the
like
50s,
the Errol
but
Flynn
for some
era.
Reason, yeah, and the 80s sword battles feel so cheap. Like, they feel so badly choreographed, and there's, like, no, it just feels very, like, okay, this is very, like, fake. And
maybe
forced.
Because you don't feel the stakes, it doesn't feel like the hero's gonna lose, even if there's 100 people going against him, because he can't, because you're in the middle of the movie.
I agree. I really loved Val Kilmer. He has one of my favorite lines in the movie, which I wrote down. It was when they're like, oh, you said you loved her. And he goes, I don't love her. She kicked me in the face. And just the thought that he apparently ad-libbed a whole bunch of his lines.
It feels like an ad-lib line, but it works.
Yeah. But he was great. And Warwick Davis is great. There were little moments here and there that were fun. Like, there's, like, that wagon chase scene. And then there.
Yeah, that was pretty. That was pretty cool.
I thought that was fun. It's a, like I said, it's a hard, it has such a, like, its heart's in the right place. The movie has good intentions. It makes it very hard to, like, be like, oh, this movie sucks. It's not good in any conventional sense, other than those two performances, I think, are really great.
What do you think of the sleight of hand at the very end? Was that kind of telegraphed, his whole disappearing rabbit trick?
Right, exactly. So, yeah. It was tough to get engaged with the movie, and it's such a long movie. It's 2+ hours long, so
it's really
very
long.
Hard to get into its ebb and flow. It feels very, like, sometimes it's very fun, sometimes it's very slow. So it was tough.
This should have been a 90-minute movie trimmed for pace. Like, that is true. It definitely lags, like, the beginning with the midwife could be like half its length. You know, Willow could get the call to adventure a little faster. Like, I understand they were setting up him and his world.
Yeah.
You know, and then just keep Val Kilmer with him the whole rest of the time. You don't need them separating and coming back together.
Right.
You know, they're both trying to get to the, you know, the sorceress. And then from there, you know, they lose the baby, and that's the turn. And then they got to get the baby back. You know, and it's like, again, you could easily shave half an hour off this movie.
It's the repetitive nature of those events. And like you said, the separations and the bringing
them
back.
You're
just
backtracking.
The fact that it's like, it throws the pacing off so dramatically that you're kind of like, again, okay, all right. So, but yeah, I don't know. How do you feel? I mean, we seem to be pretty much on the same page.
Yeah, again, it's enjoyable to watch, but I don't feel like I need to buy it and add it to my collection. I think my kids would like it? Possibly. I mean, there's I guess I'd say there's a long queue of other things I'd rather show them first that are better and more enjoyable to me. So So without that kind of nostalgia factor, like
so
I said,
so you're
going
to rob them of the nostalgia factor, which is the only thing that this movie has working in its favor.
Well, is a second generation once removed nostalgia factor? Does it even work? But I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think, it's a good movie for what it is. And I'm glad it's made. I like most people, I don't feel like I need to actively champion this movie, but I also don't feel like I need to slam it because it's what it is.
It is, and it doesn't, it's like we're saying, it doesn't have this amazing reputation that we have to debunk, and it's fine. It doesn't surprise me that people really are affectionate about this movie. I think I'd be more surprised if there was a more massively enthusiastic fan base that was like, this is one of the best movies ever made.
I feel like it's kind of summed up. Do you ever see the movie Fanboys, where they're like trying to break into Lucasfilm Ranch?
I've heard of it. I've heard of this movie, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's really, really good. There's a scene where they've broken in and they're in the Lucasfilm archives, and it's like that room, and it's obviously not the actual archive, but it's got like all sorts of Lucasfilm props and stuff, and they're like, oh, look at this, oh, look at that, and they're just messing with all the stuff. And one of the nerdiest of the guys is like, oh, look, guys, it's like Willow's wand. And everyone looks at him like, who cares? There's like Darth Vader's right there. And it's like, but this one guy is like super pumped and jazzed that he's holding Willow's wand. It's like, that's what it feels like. It's like one out of five nerds recommends.
Right.
You know, I feel that adequately describes.
So I guess then. On a scale of 1 to 5 fanboys geeking out about Willow's wand, that could sound really dirty. How many on a scale of 1 to 5 would you give it, with 5 being the highest?
I'd give it a 2. I mean, it's not garbage, but it's not garbage. It's not garbage. No, I'd give it a 2, and I think I definitely would show it to someone, but the queue in front of it of Much Better is way, way longer.
Yeah. If somebody came to me and said, oh, should I see Willow? I'd be like, if you want.
If you could find it for a couple bucks at a yard sale.
It is on YouTube, by the way, because it's not available streaming anywhere, and it's not readily
available.
They
didn't want to put money into re-releasing this in Blu-ray. I'm shocked
there's a Blu-ray. In the video I'm telling you about, Warwick Davis and Val Kilmer talk about this Blu-ray that apparently existed at one point. But yeah, I'd give it probably 2 out of 5 as well. But two typically is like, for me, 2.5 is, I'm like, it's okay. 2.5, 3 stars, I'm kind of like, eh, it's fine. 2 to me is like, I didn't like it. And Willow, I guess I would say I didn't like it, but not in the sense that it was a miserable experience. It was just a movie that doesn't work in all the ways it should, but carries enough charm that I can't actively dislike it without feeling kind of bad. But that's that. Well, I'm glad we got to watch this. I'm glad we finally got to check it off our lists.
I know. Well, now I think in the future we'll need to do Fanboys at some point, because you should watch that one. It is a lot of fun.
That will be great. And Darren, you are an active participant on the Nerd Party. Where can people find you here and elsewhere?
Here and abroad. As I get swept down river in my perfectly made basket, they can find me here on the Nerd Party talking Star Trek every week on City Alpha 3 with my friends Philip and Daniel. And they can also listen to one of our hiatus shows, Goodnight Moon, that I do with my daughter, that we are working on some new episodes. But it's been like a year and a half, I think, since
it's
we
so
posted something. But we talk about science and space and all sorts of fun stuff. And I'm interested to bring that back and do a little more of that. It'll be enjoyable. But if they want to find me on social media, they can find me under Dr. Sci-Fi on Twitter, Twitch, or Instagram, or my website, drsci-fi.com.
And I am at @YeSeanDorman on Twitter. And you can find me here on the Nerd Party on Missing Frames. I also pop up every so often on Filibuster, and there are tons of great shows to listen to. So you have SETI Alpha 3, which is great, and you have all these other shows, Nerd Nuptial, Filibuster, which I already mentioned, Time and Space, which is focused on Doctor Who, Aggressive Negotiations, all about Star Wars. I mean, literally everything your nerdy heart could possibly Desire. We've got it. And if you
and
like
now
see,
Willow.
And now Willow.
The circle is now complete.
We've now cornered the market on Willow focused podcasts. This is your number one hub for everything. People who don't hate and don't necessarily like Willow. But we're here. We're here. We love you, and we hope you love us. If you do love us, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, and feel free to share this with your friends if you think they would like it. And thank you again for listening. Thank you, Darren, for being on the show. And we'll be back. We'll be back. Don't worry. When Willow 2 comes around, we'll come swinging in.
It'll be nice to dust off that top-loading VCR again.